Welcome back to Hack Job. Today, we're with the Gilberts. Okay, guys, are you ready to see your new kitchen?
Let's go!
Take a look! Oh, here we go! It looks amazing!
You didn't do anything. We just put Bud Light on the counter.
Exactly! It totally opens it up. We gave it a fun vibe. Clearly, this is a room people want to hang out
in. It's the sure sign of a good time. Just right taste of Bud Light. Here we go.
The landscapers are here! Nice!
Here comes Mahler to the plate! He has stolen home! The ball gets by Harper, and holding up at third base is Darrell Hamilton. Molitor steals home, and the Brewers lead 4-1.
Well, you don't see it very often, primarily because the pitchers usually go from a stretch, but he is in the windup, as you saw, and the ball gets by Harper as he tries to make a quick catch and a quick tag. So a good play. That's one of the plays that has kind of gone out over the years. You used to do that an awful lot, but it's an exciting play.
A can of Old Bay. A dock worker from Locust Point, a doctor from Sinai, a hairdresser from Patterson Park, and a firefighter from Glendon. There's a fourth grader from Friendship Academy, and a lacrosse star for Boys Latin, a Catholic priest, and an Orthodox rabbi, a grandma from Dundalk, and a drummer from Hamilton. What's inside a can of Old Bay? You are. Old Bay, for 75 years, it's been the can that connects us.
Can't get it. Gets by it.
Could be an inside the park home run.
Rolls all the way to the wall, and Charlie Moore scores. Molitor is around third. He's coming home. There will be no play. Now take a look at the Milwaukee bench. We'll see a little action.
Well, that was an unusual play. Freddie really took quite a chance. Four-run lead. If you catch the ball, it's great. If you don't, as it turned out, you put two runs on the board.
There's no doubt about it. I would want my center fielder to play that on one hop.
Once it got past Lynn, there was just it rolled all the way out about 400 feet.
Reggie got there quickly, but Molitor's got some good speed, and here you see it.
Studio complex, straight out of God's country, Pawleys Island, South Carolina. The Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network proudly presents Backwards K Pod. And now, here's the host of the show, Jake Robinson.
I never move in slow-mo. Welcome to my dojo. Those other pods are so-so. I'm chill like bro-yo. Focus like a GoPro. Ripping up this promo. Check out the scoreboard. Preach something with no-nos. It's going. No, it's gone. Your heart just stopped. Cause Jake got strong and mighty. Undefeated, I mean it. Pull up the pods, scroll it down, then read it. Written, produced, directed, and mixed. Dog on your lips and Ozzy Smith back lips. Pick a tip, any tip, get on to it. I got ridiculous pods without pulsing it. You sit at home crying like a girl while I spread the gospel around the world. Yo, the pods are written behind tracks that mixed in smooth with the groove to make ears want to listen. Add a little cut and a rhythm to back it up. Another short of my name, now watch me stack them up. You think another way rap back, but this ain't no act tag. My hobbies are rhymes, some people trying to be black, but that best time I come out, call the show BKP and I'll be turning out. Yo, Big Jake, State Border 71. Dates, you know what time it is, I'm packing them guns. Your experience, I've been a witness to glory, and that's why I collect ball players and their stories. You heard? So. Once again, back is the incredible, the pod animal, Jake the Snake Robinson, from the Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network. I'm coming out of Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Hat man, hat podcast machine, back in the Captain Kirk chair, shields down, bolt on, up. prepare to engage on this week's digital audio program that I call Backwards K-Pop, where we collect ball players and their stories. What's cracking, C-Meds? What's juicy? Happy opening day. I hope all of you enjoyed sitting back watching some baseball game one of the 2024 season. Welcome back into the dojo for chapter 127 in the never-ending collection of ballplayers, moments, stadiums, personalities, as well as the pop culture references that have had a profound impact on our national pastime conscience. My goal in life with the remaining days that I draw breath, however many days that may be, is to gather my Seamhead choir of angels and preach the gospel of baseball to a worldwide congregation. Earth, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the BKP Time Travel Choo-Choo. The mission to explore strange new worlds of stories to be passed down to the Seamheads of tomorrow. To separate truth from fiction, the apocryphal from facts. To boldly go where no man has gone before. Hello, everybody. It's your boy, Reverend Snake Robinson. I got your hookup. Holler if you hear me. Backwards K-Pod is available on all platforms, wherever you listen to your pods. I will never charge you for the baseball content here at Backwards K-Pod. No Patreon, no Twitch, no pay-to-play for subscriptions. Never going to charge you for a bonus show. Information is power, and I want nothing but empowered Seamheads in my circle. If you want to pay me back, cool. Keep your money, take care of your family. Just share my show with your Seamhead buddies. Subscribe or follow the show on whatever platform they may be. iHeart, Apple, Spotify, Podbean, even Alexa will bend her face down, ass up if you ask her to play the show. I'm all tangled up in the web, bro. Rate and review me as you see fit. I ain't scared. I do what I do when I do it, and I do it better than anybody else. And I say that in all humility. And all these things I ask of you help me to maintain a solid Google profile, enables me to do the one thing I love most in this world, and that is opine the seams with you beautiful-minded baseball freaks. Plus, it helps me feed my felonious feline of a co-host, Charlie Guns, who's in studio as usual with me today, ready to tip the celestial scales once again and take us on our time-bending travels for this week. And speaking of my boy Charlie Guns, who I named after Gunnar Henderson, I want to thank the band of listeners who came together like Voltron and got me a Gunnar Henderson autographed Orioles batting helmet and came with a thoughtful card. And I absolutely love it, fellas. I mean, really. I love it. I am truly touched by the graciousness of the gift. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's straight fire. Best birthday gift probably ever in my life. And I'm sure it'll be buried with me when it's all over. Thank you so much. And with that, let's do the damn thing. I know I'm a little late this week, but, you know, I'm a believer that opening day should be a national holiday. So I took the day off yesterday. I figured I'd just drop it today. I'm ready to take the mound, give you 130 pitches today if we need them, which I doubt we will. I felt good in the bullet today. I got 3 pitches working for me. We got more ground to cover than Andrew Jones out of Fulton County Stadium this week. So let's get after it, you remaining stragglers on the platform here at Terrapin Station. Load up our BKP time travel choo-choo for this week's adventure. As I look to the west of Terrapin, straight into right field of our beautiful Jewel Box Stadium with her immaculately manicured playing field, the fans are in their seats, ready to root on our home team, BKP9. The pitcher has completed his warm-up tosses. The catcher has gone down to second. The infield has thrown that ball around the infield with the snap and swagger. The umpire has called play ball. So, that is my cue. I'm calling all aboard. As Gunner will be setting our time and destination to August 22nd, 1956, St. Paul, Minnesota, to witness the baseball rise of one Paul Molitor this week. So, hurry, hurry, step right up, get in where you fit in, get yourself real comfortable in my state-of-the-art time travel diesel. Take off your shoes. Kick up your feet. Open your kimonos. Ladies, rip off those bras. Stuff them in your purse for later. Let the twins hang. Get yourself real comfortable. We don't judge. Let your hair down. Let's jump into my sandbox here and build sandcastles together this week, shall we? And as Gunner hits the necessary quantum speeds to hit 1.6 gigahertz of radio frequency on our spectrum analyzer, tearing through interdimensional wormholes and portals, bending both space-time and history, I thought really hard about the course of this week's story. And when I think of Paul Molitor, I always go back to hit number 3,000 of a baseball conscience, the prodigal son had returned to his native Minneapolis, St. Paul roots, and was now clad in Twins gear. The image of his right center field base hit while he scrambles around the bags like a man with his hair on fire, sliding hit first into third base, Charlie Hustle style. The first player in Major League Baseball history to hit a triple for the milestone 3,000 hit. And Molitor enjoyed a number of memorable moments in a Twins uniform through the final 3 years of his 21-season Hall of Fame career. The 21st player to reach the 3,000-hit threshold, he was the second player from St. Paul, Minnesota to do it. Dave Winfield, who, like Paul, had emerged from the sandlots of St. Paul to star for the University of Minnesota Golden Gophers, he had achieved the mark 3 years earlier to the day, also wearing Twinkies gear. And then the twilight of a Hall of Fame career. Molitor's path to third base that September evening of 1996 had many twists and turns along the way. Hamstrung by a series of devastating injuries early in his career as an infielder with the Brewers, Molitor seemingly developed a reputation of fragility, and it appeared as though his career was snake-bitten as season after season would be cut short with injuries. But the soft-spoken right-handed hitting extraordinaire would persevere to achieve milestones of durability as a designated hitter for the Blue Jays and Twins. A fixture atop the Milwaukee Brewers for 15 years as one of baseball's best leadoff hitters. And sidebar, folks, when I think of baseball in the 1980s, I always go back to, it was truly the age of leadoff hitters. Almost every team had that pitcher atop the lineup. You had the two best leadoff hitters in Ricky and Reigns, Molitor, Vince Coleman, Lou Whitaker, Pete Rose, Rod Carew, Al Bummer, Steve Sachs, Willie Randolph, Willie Wilson. Pound for pound, dollars to donuts, the best group of leadoff hitters ever to this day. And Molitor was elite status amongst them. He was one of the greatest base runners ever. Not necessarily for his speed. Don't get me wrong. He was dumb fast, but there have been faster. But there have been very few with better base running instincts in my lifetime of watching this game. He was nicknamed the Igniter, and he hated that fucking nickname. He said that he never entered a room and people would say, "Hey, the Igniter is here." What a stupid nickname he has often signed. His closest of friends and teammates always called him Pauly or Molly. But still, as the leadoff stick in the Brewers' batting order for that decade and a half, Molly would ignite rallies for Harvey's Wallbangers, the 1982 AL pennant winning team that he and close friend Robin Yount led Milwaukee to the World Series, a team that I covered extensively in that banging-ass BKP archive. Go check it out if you haven't heard. And former Brewers teammate Dave Engel once observed, "In Milwaukee, it's God, Robin Yount, and Paul Molitor." Upon leaving Milwaukee, Molitor replaces Winfield as the DH in the middle of the Jays lineup in 1993. And just as Winfield had done in 92, Mahler helped the Blue Jays win a World Series title in 1993. He is remembered as a clutch hitter, appearing in 5 postseason playoff series, including 2 World Series, and batting .368. And while most assuredly one needs to take this stat with a reminder of all the confounding facts involved, it is interesting to note that during his career, his teams were 1,382 wins, 1,268 losses, a .522 winning percentage. And that's opposed to the 281 wins, 349 losses, .446 winning percentage when he was out of the game. And surely, I'm not saying they won every game because of him, but the truth is, if you had a healthy Molly on the field today, you had a great chance of winning that ball game. And the numbers, by far, bear that out. A player rep for most of his career, Mahler was the eye in the storm for several highly publicized contract negotiations. He won a battle versus cocaine abuse that plagued him early on when injuries were ravaging his career. And he is a testament to the belief that every second of every day offers the opportunity to turn it all around. And here we are, folks, tearing through that last wormhole and straight into St. Paul, Minnesota, August 22nd, 1956, as parents Kathleen and Richard Mahler are excited to meet Paul Leo Mahler, their 5th of what will be 8 children in total, 6 girls and 2 boys. When Mahler began playing organized baseball, he lived near Grand Avenue of Pascal Street. And even as a 7-year-old, Paulie is earning a recognition as a great baseball player and athlete. When he is 8, the family will move into a large 3-story Victorian home at the corner of Portland Avenue and Oxford Street. By this time, he remembers already being a huge Twins fan, and he smiles remembering his pops throwing balls high against the fence as Paul would pretend to be his favorite Twinkie, Bob Allison, robbing batters of would-be dongs. And one of the reasons Molly wore number 4 was an homage to Allison. In his new hood, he begins balling out at the nearby Oxford Playground, which was being celebrated for the recent play of another future Hall of Famer, Dave Winfield, who was 5 years his senior. Molly took the baseball like a fish in water, and early on, as long as he can remember, he had Major League scene dreams. In his yearbook as a senior, he declared his ambition to play baseball and help people. He was quickly recognized as a neighborhood jock, as he played in various youth leagues, most notably for Addis Brooks American Legion Post 606. In youth leagues, he often squared against another St. Paul baseball legend, Jack Morris. As a youngster, and as an omen of things to come, Mahler suffered a number of fluke injuries. When he was around 8 or 9 years old, he fell out of a tree. A couple years later, he injured his feet while riding his bike barefoot. And as a teenager, Molly is given a baseball autograph by Babe Ruth, and it made such an impression on him that Paul was notorious for collecting autographs during his playing career, as he would chase down Hall of Famers at old-timer events. So by the early 90s, he had amassed over 45 balls of legends. He attended Creighton High School, a Catholic military prep academy that was legendary for the athletics, and Paulie would go down as one of the best athletes in the school's storied history. He lettered in soccer, basketball, and baseball. His sophomore, junior, and senior seasons from 1972 to 1974, winning titles in each sport, and he was named All-State in both baseball and basketball. In one of the baseball state tournaments, Creighton was trailing 2-1. Molly steps to the plate with the bases drunk, and he has worked the count to 3-0. High school and American Legion coach Bill Peterson gives Molitor the take sign, and the next pitch is way over Molly's head, but he ignored the take sign and he swung anyway. And fortunately for Molitor and Creighton High School, Molitor tomahawks the pitch over the left field fence for the grand slam eventual game winner. After his senior year, the St. Louis Cardinals came a call him, and they draft Molly in the 28th round as a low draft pick. Molitor was considered a long shot to make the majors, and accordingly, the Cards offered him a signing bonus of only $4,000. $4,000 in 1974 is worth about $25,000 in the 2024 economy. And as he was making his decision on the Cards, Dick Siebert, the University of Minnesota baseball coach, offered him a pool ride. And it didn't take long for Paulie to impress. In 1975, as a freshman, Golden Gopher, he makes the team as the starting second baseman. He hits .375, and he just barely misses out on the Big Ten first team by one vote. The next year, Siebert moves Molitor shortstop, and Paul puts up his college career year. He hit .406, which was third best in the conference, finishes second in home runs and fourth in runs. He is named to the All-Big Ten team and his first team All-American, only the seventh Gopher to receive that honor. The team finished 36-9, earns a berth in the NCAA Rocky Mountain Regional Tourney, where they were later bounced by number one seed Arizona State. Later that season, Paul suffers a fractured jaw, ending his summer baseball season. He kicks off his junior year with a slow start, and he admittedly was pressing with scouts following him from campus to campus, but he would recover, turn in a fine season. He hits .325 with 6 home runs, 20 stolen bases, and he repeats as an All-Big Ten first-teamer. The team finished 39-12, qualified again for the NCAA postseason. While playing in the Midwest region, the Gophers won 3 games and earned a berth in their college world and the College World Series, their fifth and most recent appearance. They would lose 2 of 3, the last being to Arizona State again, who would eventually win it all, while the Gophers finished 6th. Once again, Molitor finds himself eligible for the MLB Amateur Draft, and once again, he is selected. This time by the Brewers of Milwaukee in the first round with the 3rd overall pick, Brew Crew scout Dee Fondy signed Molly for $80,000, which is around $409,000 today. At the time of his jump to pro ball, Molly held several University of Minnesota batting records. However, most have been broken due to today's longer seasons. Because of his on-field excellence as a Golden Gopher, the school retired his number. After the draft, the Brewers invited their new phenom to County Stadium for a meet and greet. Molly remembers feeling self-conscious, feeling like a dork with his way too big suit on. And at one point, he is sitting next to Robin Yount, who is 22 years old, but already had 5-year veteran Major League Baseball seasons. Veteran third baseman and team captain Sal Bando walks by, throws an outfielder glove in Yount's lap, and says, "Well, kid, this will be your last year playing shortstop." And Molitor always winces when reminiscing of the story, as the whole thing made him uneasy, and he remembers how he just wanted to run out of that clubhouse. Molitor knew he wasn't quite ready to push Yount out of the infield. And after his visit, the 20-year-old kid plays for Burlington Iowa Ball Club in the Class A Midwest League. The Bees were 28-42 in the season's first half. But when Molly came aboard, the club went 43-26. In 64 games, the St. Paul kid hit 364, hammered 8 home runs, drove in 50 to win the Midwest League MVP, and Prospect of the Year honors. In the playoffs, the Bees stung Cedar Rapids, Iowa in the first round, and then met Waterloo, Iowa. The Bees would beat up the Waterloo team to capture the league championship. His solid half season earned Paul a trip to the Brewers spring training camp in Chandler, Arizona. New manager George Bamberger and GM Harry Dalton had inherited a Milwaukee club that had finished six out of seven teams in the 1977 AL East race, ahead of only the expansion team Toronto Blue Jays and 33 games behind the pennant-winning Yankees. The Brewers had every intention of farming out the St. Paul native to Spokane and the PCL for additional season. However, Robin Yount injured his foot and was unable to go on opening day. So Mahler, despite only a half season of experience in Class A, is named Bamberger's starting shortstop, and he finds himself going in as the leadoff stick. The Igniter, the Igniter, made his MLB debut on opening day, Friday, April 7, 1978, at County Stadium. He grounded out his first at bat, then singled to left and drove in a run against Orioles southpaw Mike Flanagan in the second inning of an 11-3 win. The next day, he belts his first home run, a three-run shot off Joe Kerrigan. He singles twice, drives in five, and Milwaukee's 16-3 drubbing of the O's. In the third game, he adds three more hits to his average. Boy, oh boy. I mean, he just splooged ropes all over my Orioles' faces, right? Wow. When Yount returns to action, Bamberger moves Molly to second base, and he continues to mash, sporting a .322 average in mid-June. And Bamberger's falling head over heels for this kid. Molly had tremendous baseball instincts, and he could tell right away that the young man possessed exceptional athleticism. He was amazed how Paul, the rookie, played beyond his experience. Nothing fazed him. He was never overwhelmed. But Molly's bat cools off in September, and he bats just 1-3 in the season's final month. Bamberger always attributed that swoon to the fact that it was the most baseball in a season Paul had ever played in his life, and he just got worn down. Nevertheless, Mahler finishes with a .273 average, 30 stolen bases to earn the Sporting News Rookie of the Year honors. And while the Brewers didn't challenge the Yankees or Red Sox in 1978, they did improve from 67 victories to 93 under Bamberger. The Brew Crew takes another step forward in 1979 when they won 95 games to finish second in the American League East behind the Baltimore Orioles. Mahler improved on his previous year, hitting .322, which was sixth best in the American League, and he swiped 33 bags. And the Brewers had one of the most stout middle infields in Yount and Molly. He starts off the 1980 season white hot, but on June 6th, while he's battering opposing pitchers to a .358 clip, he pulls a muscle in his ribcage and was forced out of the lineup for 6 weeks. He's elected to play in his first All-Star game. He attends the game in Los Angeles, but he's unable to play. To fill the void a second in his absence, the Brewers promote Ford Dulac, Wisconsin native, Jim Gantner in his stead. And while he was laid up, Molly develops a nasty cocaine addiction. And this is because of the idle time and frustration with his injury. He rushes his return, and his average fell to .304 by the season's end. His heavy drug use continues in the offseason, and on Christmas Day 1980, he bottoms out. When he fails to turn up at his parents' home that morning, they begin to worry. And His fiancée, Linda Newport, stayed over at his agent's house that night while the agent was out of town. So she goes over and begins banging on the door. And Paul was passed out after a cocaine-induced party and could not awaken from his stupor. When he finally does, Linda's very upset, agitated, threatens to leave him if he doesn't get his shit together. And Molly himself begins to recognize the depths of his addiction. And he had been raised Catholic, attended Catholic school, but he admits he had gotten away from his spiritual grounding. And he begins to invest himself back into his faith. And he gives all the glory of beating his addiction to God. The 1981 season was a frustrating year for Molitor. Buck Rogers, who had split time with Bamberger at the Brewers' home in 1980, due to Bambi's heart problems, was now officially in charge upon Bamberger's retirement. And over the 1980-1981 offseason, Dalton and Rogers decided to keep Gantner at second and move Molly to center field. Now, they shipped for slugger Gorman Thomas to move to right field, which the big fellow resented in a lot of ways. To help Molly with this transition, the Brewers brought in former Yankee and outfield guru Sam Saplesio to mentor the young player. Saplesio took outfield defense seriously, and the Brewers hoped that with an intense private tutorial, he could make Paulie into a competent major league outfielder. As the 81 season opened, he had his struggles here and there, but he seemed to catch on quickly. At the plate, he clobbers his first grand slam on April 22nd, but his season is cut short May 3rd out of the Big A, the game versus the Halos, when he suffers an ankle injury trying to beat out a grounder. And while he was injured, the players went on strike. When the season resumed, Molly was just adequate over the remainder of the season. For the last four games, Rogers adjusted his positional experiment, moved Molitor to right field. Storm and Gorman, who had been playing center field in Molly's absence, stayed at his natural position. And the Brewers edged the Tigers to win the ALE's second half race, earned the right to meet the first half champion Yankees in a divisional playoff series. Molitor collects five hits in the series. He drops three-run dog against the Bronx Bombers in game three. But the Yanks would take the series 3-2. Rogers, again, decides to move Molitor in 1982, this time to third base. By now, Molly is getting frustrated with all the shifting. Last year, they said I was the center fielder of the future. Now I guess I'm the third baseman of the future. Shit, if Raleigh Fingers retires in a few years, I guess I'll be the closer of the future. And again, we talked about this 1992 Brewers season extensively in our BKP Harvey Wallbanger show, available on all podcast platforms and that banging-ass catalog. So I won't spend a lot of time on the 82 season, as it is all basically a rehash. If you remember, that team started off slowly that season, floundering in fifth place on June 2nd. Dalton replaces Rogers with Harvey Keene. The Brewers, energized by the move, go 25-11 under his tutelage and going into the All-Star break tied for first with the Orioles. The crew and the O's battled down a stretch, and it came down to a four-game series where the Brewers had to win one game to take the AL East pennant. The Orioles won the first three games of the series, but the Brewers managed to stave off the Birds in the final game of the year when Yount homered twice and Don Sutton out-dueled Jim Palmer. It was an injury-free year that saw Molly play in 160 games. He led the league in runs with 136, stole 41 bags, collected 201 hits, which was third in the league behind teammates Yount, who had 210, and first baseman Cecil Cooper with 205. Oh, good Lord, could Harvey Wallbangers hit the goddamn ball? That's 616 hits between three players, Reese. Let that sink into your cerebellum. That doesn't happen much. In fact, There's probably been only a handful of times that that's ever happened. They go to the ALCS. They meet the California Angels. The Cherubs quickly jump out to a 2-0 advantage in the best of 5 series, despite Mariners inside the park home run in game 2. But the resilient Brew Crew bounces back, winning their next 3 at County Stadium, in which Molly paced the Brewers' offensive attack by slugging .648, scoring 4 runs, and driving in 5. Milly Wauke opens the 1982 World Series at Busch Stadium to face off with the National League champion St. Louis Cardinals. In the first game, Molitor set a Fall Classic record with 5 hits, all singles, to lead the Brewers to a 10-0 rout. After the Cards won the next 2 games, Milwaukee captured games 4 and 5 at County Stadium, but the fourth will prove to be elusive. Back home at Busch, the Cards won Game 6, 13-1. Mulder, who batted .355 in the season, collected 2 hits in Game 7. But the Cards won 6-3 behind the stellar pitching of Joaquin Andujar and Bruce Sutter. After the 1982 season, the Brewers suffered a hangover in 1983. Mulder signs a 5-year, $5.1 million contract before the season injures his wrist in May. He then struggles with that sore wrist in the worst slump of his career. With a stretch that season, go 2-41. He goes hitless in his last 25 at-bats of the season. And he bats .270 while the team falls to 5th place. And I should note that $5.1 million in 1983 is worth around $26 million in the 2024 economy. During that season, his old coke dealer, Tony Peters, was arrested. Mulder and his attorney negotiated immunity from prosecution and a commitment that in exchange for answering all the questions that investigators had. And under the auspice that he would not be called to testify in trial unless absolutely necessary. In the end, Mulder was forced to was not forced to testify when Peters went to trial, and he avoided punishment from baseball authorities as well. But his name and those of 4 other players came out public early in the 1984 season during the trial. And sidebar here, folks. Thankfully, this didn't happen in 2024 when every Tom, Dick, and Harry has an open platform to spew nonsense. Everyone would become, overnight lawyers, detectives, and speculators. Like, what's going on now with Ohtani? Or, God forbid, the Key Bridge in Baltimore. You know, now that's all mired in, you know, everybody's a fucking engineer and a goddamn boat expert. You know, conspiracy theories, all this crap. I mean, I don't know what the world is coming to today. I mean, this shit with Ohtani is just ridiculous. They try to equate his sins into letting Pete Rose back into the graces of baseball. It's absolute horseshit. But I digress. In the spring of 1984, Molly is diagnosed with an MCL tear. He opened the season limited to DH duty, and in late April, he tried a few games at third base. The elbow is growing increasingly tender. And with Mulder batting .217 on May 1st, the crew shut him down for the season for TJ surgery. The Brewers, just 2 years removed from a World Series appearance, slid to last place in the American League East, 36.5 games behind the eventual world champion Tigers, another team I covered here at BKP with the Bless You Boys 1984 Tigers tribute show. After the season, he and his wife Linda welcomed their daughter Blair into the world. Bam Berger returns to the helm in 1985, and he returns Molly back to third base and the leadoff stick in the lineup. With his elbow troubles behind him, he plays on 135 games at the hot corner. On July 2nd, he doubles, scores the winning run versus the Red Sox, for his 1,000th hit. And his season was relatively injury-free until the end of August when he missed 2 weeks with a sprained ankle. 1986 is another injury-plagued year for Paul. He tore his hamstring on May 9th, charging a bunt in Anaheim. He hit a home run when he returned May 30th, but he only played 3 more games before aggravating the injury again and going back on the DL. He returns June 7th, but 2 days later, he again tears a hammy playing in the outfield. He comes back July 9th as the DH. Later that month, they move him back to third, and he plays the rest of the season relatively injury-free. On August 19th, he melts 2 bombs, smashes 2 doubles, going 4-for-4 in a 5-3 win versus Cleveland. He finished the year batting .281 in 105 games. At this point in his career, it seems that maybe Molly's star in the baseball universe was beginning to diminish. He's 30 years old now, 3 years removed from playing in 140 games, and 4 years removed from hitting .300. The Brewers kick off the 1987 season hot, tying a modern major league record of 13 straight wins to open the season. Molly is a spark by hitting .395 in his first 20 games. 18 of those were Brewers wins. Unfortunately, again, Molitor is injured and a rundown between third and home. He tears his hamstring again. He misses 4 weeks, comes back, then misses more games with groin and elbow problems before re-injuring the hammy once again. When he returns to the lineup on July 16th versus the Cherubs, he had 1 hit, a double, and 4 at-bats. Now, he's become limited to DH over the next couple weeks. Molly began rapping out hits consistently, and he begins attracting attention for his hit streak as the pressure mounted. The introspective Polly kept the streak in perspective. In Milwaukee, on August 23rd, he goes 1-for-4 against the Royals to push his hit streak to 38 games and pass Tommy Holmes for the 7th longest streak in Major League Baseball history, behind Joe DiMaggio's venerated 56-game hit streak. 3 nights later, Molly is at home versus the Tribe, going for his 40th consecutive game with a hit, which would have tied him with Ty Cobb for 6th on the all-time list. He goes hitless in 4 at-bats, and he's standing on deck when teammate Rick Manning singled home the winning run in the 9th. Even though the game ended without him having a chance to push the streak, the fans gave him a standing ovation. His 39-game hit streak was one of the longest in baseball history. Only Pete Rose and his 44-game hit streak is longer in the integrated modern game. And only DiMaggio, George Sisler, Ty Cobb, Wee Willie Keeler, and Bill Dolan are in front of him, along with Rose. Buoyed by the streak, Molitor turned in his best season statistically, batting .353, second in the American League behind only Wade Boggs. He led the league in doubles with 41, runs with 114, an astounding number considering he only played in 118 games. He also swiped 45 bags, became the 33rd player to steal second, third, and home in the same inning. His OBP was .438. He had a .566 slug, by far the highest of his career. His OPS was 1.033, the league's second best. He came 5th in AL MVP voting, and he was nominated the Comeback Player of the Year. And folks, let's stick a pin in the Molitor bio right here. I'm going to step out, plot in my head the direction for Acts 2 and 3 of the story. Hook up my boy Gunner with some treats for a great first segment ode. Rip a few tunes. Collect my thoughts on where to go from here. Please support the grassroots sponsors that support your grassroots baseball pod. Laparose Hand Cleaners. No Mo Smelly Hands. I'll get Posquatch to tell you all about it. BRB, you freaks. See you on the dark side of the moon.
It's been so lonely, girl, without you here.
like a bird without a song.
It was time to return to our regularly scheduled program.
Up into the air goes Tatis, and he robs him of a home run.
Walk-off grand slam by Bobby Witt Jr.
What a play by Baez! Are you kidding me?
A career-high 11 strikeouts, Justin Steele.
A game-tying grand slam from Pete Alonso. There's a high fly ball, deep right field. Pepper watches it fly.
The next 2-2.
Center, well hit. Eisenreich on the run, looking up. It's off the wall. White speeding toward third. He'll come around to score. Molitor in the third with a triple. And the Blue Jays lead 1-0.
Well, there'd be a game seven. Gilson said he wouldn't know until tomorrow.
Molitor reducing the likelihood of a game seven somewhat. With a tremendous blast into the second deck and left. They were chanting MVP very faintly in some sections of Sky Dome when he stepped in. That's a chant that might pick up some steam
in his last appearance in Game 4.
Line into center, falling fast, the hit. Third of the night for Molitor. Henderson stops at second.
Paul Molitor has been a hitting machine in this series. His 12th hit is now 12 for 23 in the series.
Howdy, y'all. This is Big Tex Gage Geek, executive producer of Backwards K Pod. In Texas, we do everything big. After football and golf, there's probably nothing I love more than going fishing and enjoying a good crawfish boil. The only thing I dislike about going fishing is the lingering odor it can leave on your hands afterwards. Well, the Fish and Hand Cleaner is an all-natural liquid soap perfect for overpowering fish and bait odors from your hands. I can't tell you how many times I've eaten steamed crabs, lobster, shrimp, crawfish, and then washed my hands with regular soap, only to touch my eyes half hour later and my face begins to melt off due to the damn Cajun Old Bay spices. Well, we also have a hand cleaner specifically formulated to use after eating shellfish and other seafoods. Perfect for cleaning spicy, smelly hands after a Texas-sized seafood feast. In these cases, don't settle for anything less than our crawfish hand cleaner, our crab hand cleaner, or the fishing hand cleaner. An ingenious trifecta of natural hand soaps developed and owned by a disabled Navy veteran. He and Jake have a true connection, as they were boot camp shipmates all the way back in 1989. So he is family, folks. And one thing we do here at the Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network is look out for family. So you can support two grassroots companies by two former shipmate Navy vets. Crushing big bowls of shellfish or fishing on the banks of your favorite river while you listen to BKP. Sounds like a great day. You know, in fact, hey Mom, where are my poles? I'm gone fishing. There's also a buffalo wing hand cleaner in development as we speak. To check all of the incredible products of this great company, you can go to www.crawfishhandcleaner.com. Or call the home offices at 713-588-0290. That's 713-588-0290.
1-800-930-9090 to support the grassroots company that supports your grassroots podcast show. That's crawfishhandcleaner.com or 713-588-0290 to prepare for your summertime shellfish feast or that fishing trip you're planning. crawfishhandcleaner.com.
To right center field. Myers and Nunley chase it. Myers, the ball drops. Mahler has his 3,000th hit, and he's chugging to third. And he's in with a triple. Paul Mahler becomes the 21st member of baseball's 3,000 hit club.
Season that saw Molly hit 39 consecutive games and post amazing all-round stats in only 118 games that year. After arthroscopic surgery in the offseason to his throwing elbow, Molitor signs a $2.8 million contract lead with bonuses for games played. The Igniter starts the 88 season as the DH, but soon reclaims the third base position. He is named as a starting second baseman in the Midsummer Classic, despite appearing in only one game at that position, which rankled Julio Franco. Despite minor injuries to his wrist and elbow, and of course those freaking hamstring problems, Mahler plays in 154 games and earns all of his bonuses. He begins the 1989 season on the DL with a dislocated finger, but he recovers quickly and joins the team in mid-April. He remains healthy throughout the remainder of the season and again received all his performance bonuses when he played in 155 games and he hits .315 with 27 stolen bases. He was a regular third for most of the season, but the Brewers had two shortstop prospects in Bill Spears and Gary Sheffield on the horizon, and manager Tom Trebelhorn wanted to see one of the men short and one at third base. In 1990, after signing a three-year $9.1 million deal with the Brewers, it slowly became one of the more frustrating seasons for Paul Molitor. Going into the year, the profile of the Brewers infield was still up in the air. Molly, Sheffield, Spears, Gantner, Dale Sweet, the starting shortstop in 1987 and 1988, they're all vying for three positions, second, third, and short. And unfortunately, an injury bug throughout the infield ran its course for the season. The Brewers found themselves with too few alternatives as opposed to too many. The now 33-year-old Molitor was bothered by a sore shoulder in spring training in 1991, and then he fractured his thumb. He suffered a fractured finger with a freak accident when he caught his hand in the glove of Cleveland catcher Brooke Jacoby and missed another 6 weeks. He returns at the end of July, but was unable to throw because of his sore shoulder. And Treblehorn shifts him to first base, which triggered first baseman Greg Brock, who then begins pissing and moaning to his agent. Brock's unhappiness was just another player in the clubhouse not happy with their role. Sheffield wanted to play shortstop, not third base. The team struggles as a result and drops to sixth place. Molitor hits .285 in only 130 games, and his 1990 season ends prematurely when he collides with Jim Gantner in the final week. Already slated for shoulder surgery, he undergoes a separate surgery on his forearm to repair the injury from the collision. He returns to full-time status in 1991, but no longer able to throw anymore. He has moved to the DH role, where he would pretty much stay for the rest of his career and flourish. On May 15th, the 35-year-old hits for the cycle. Later in the year, he collects hit number 2,000 off of Royals ace Brett Saberhagen. He played in 158 games, led the league in plate appearances and at-bats, batting .325 with 216 hits, led the league with 133 runs, tied for the league lead in triples with 13, and he finished 8th in OPS at .888. The Brewers bring in old scrap iron Phil Garner to manage the team in 1992. And in late May, the new skipper moved Molly from the top of the lineup to the three hole. He thrives, batting .320, driving in 89 runs, and he's named to the All-Star team, leading Milwaukee to a second place finish in the AL East, the best finish by the crew in a decade. But the economics of the game are quickly changing in 1992. Molitor, who turned 36 in August, was a free agent. And Milwaukee did not feel comfortable extending him a market value contract. He is courted by both the Red Sox and Angels before agreeing to a 3-year, $13 million deal with the world champion Toronto Blue Jays on Pearl Harbor Day during the offseason. While his former teammates, most notably Yount and Gamner, lamented his loss, Molly moved on with trepidation, but ready to embrace his new opportunity. He moves his family to Toronto, shows up early for camp. He wears 19 on his new Jays gear in honor of his friend Robin Yount, and he joined a veteran team that won the chip the year before, and he's slated to fill the void created by St. Paul native Dave Winfield, who had moved on to the Twins via free agency. And he joins the other hometown product of his native city, Jack Morris. He quickly endears himself to our Canadian cousins. In May, he bashes .374, earns AL Player of the Month honors. In July, Jays manager Cito Gaston selects Molitor to play as a reserve on his All-Star team. The Igniter hits .361 after the break, finishes second in the league in batting race behind John Olerud. He collects 111 rib sandwiches, scores 121 runs, leads the AL with 211 hits. In late September, Toronto clinches the division when Molitor hits a home run in Milwaukee at County Stadium for his new team. The next morning, Molly wakes up, opens a Milwaukee Journal newspaper, and reads a scathing story with excerpts from his agent Ron Simmons' titillating book recounting Molitor's drug abuse and intimate details of his contract squabbles with the Brewers throughout the years. Paulie synthesizes the resulting uproar over the hatchet piece, and he prepares for the ALCS in the series opener in Chicago versus the Pale Hosers. Molly collects four hits, including a two-run blast, and the Blue Jays win. game two, erase two more hits as the Jays win again. The White Sox would win games three and four before the Jays would shut it down with victories game five and six in the shop. Game six, 6-3 victory was highlighted by Molly's ninth inning triple that played to two Geico runs. And for the series, Molitor hit 391, drove in a team high five runs. Set to appear in a second World Series, Molly became the center of baseball speculation. The Jays and Bills split the first two games in Toronto, and the question becomes, how will Cito work his lineup in a National League park with no DH available? In a gutsy managerial move versus Southpaw Phillies pitcher Danny Jackson, Gaston benched left-handed hitting John Olerud, the league batting champion, in favor of Molitor, who played just 23 regular season games at first base in his major league career. The move pays off. Molitor bats third, drives in two, with a triple in the first, and he scores on a Joe Carter sack fly. He later crushed a solo dong and added a single in the 10-3 win. In games four and five, Gaston takes another gamble when he inserts Molitor and his suspect arm at third base. And his thinking is, he can risk it because the Phillies mostly have left-handed pull hitters. And again, the gamble pays off. Molitor only has three fielding chances in the two games. All were played perfectly, and all three throws on target. Game four was a slugfest. The longest nine-inning World Series game with the most combined runs scored as the Jays outlast the Phillies 15-14. A day later, Phillies ace Curt Schilling shut out Toronto to send the series back to Sky Dome, or the Rogers Center, as she's called now. Game six was an instant classic of game six proportions. Molitor triple, drives in the first run. He scores on a sack fly by Carter. In the fifth inning, the chance of MVP ringing in his ear, he bashes a solo dong, giving the Jays a 5-1 advantage. But Filthy battles back to take a 6-5 lead in the bottom of the ninth. Ricky Henderson does what great leadoff hitters do. He draws a walk to open the inning. One out later, Molitor smacks a line drive into center field. And with two on against Phillies closer Mitch Williams, Carter steps in and pounds a line drive to the left field line over the fence and into the left field bleachers. Molitor, leaping high upon the completion of the blast, scored the winning run, while Joe made sure to touch a ball, knowing that he would never hit a bigger one in his life. After the game, Molitor collapsed in emotional exhaustion and wept on the field. In the six-game series, he collected 12 hits and 24 bats, including two doubles, two triples, two home runs. He scored 10 runs, drove in eight, and he was named World Series MVP. In 1994, he again turns in a stellar injury-free season, leading the Jays with a 3.1 average. And he also leads them in runs, hits, total bases, doubles, and stolen bases. But they finished the strike season, shortened season, under 500. And in 1995, he appears in 130 games strictly as a DH, but overall, it was one of his worst statistical seasons, and at the age of 39, he appeared to be slipping. With his three-year deal set to expire, Molly finds himself a free agent once again. He considered remaining in Toronto or returning to the Brewers or maybe home to his childhood Twins. On December 5th, 1995, he signs with the Twins for $2.025 million. He starts out quickly, scoring five, driving in five, in a 24-11 win over the Tigers in April. Later that month, he put another five-game performance up, this time versus the Blue Jays. It's on September 16th, 1996, at Kauffman Stadium, Kansas City. Mahler singles in the first hit. He singles in the first. That's hit number 2,999. In the fifth, he drives a Jose Rosado drive into right center field, and he ends up on third base for his 3,000th hit. George Brett and his good friend Robin Yount were in hand to watch him join the 3,000 hit exclusive club. The milestone hit came 3 years to the day after Winfield had that mark with his childhood team, and they became the first two players from the same home team to accomplish the feat for their hometown team. Mahler was the fourth oldest player in the league at this time. He appeared in 161 games, batted 341, which was third in the AL behind Alex Rodriguez and Frank Thomas. He led the junior circuit with 225 hits, becoming the oldest player to ever lead the league in hits. And he drove in a career-high 113 runs, scoring 99 times. After the season, he signs again with Minnesota, this time a two-year deal. He wound up hitting 305 that year with 10 home runs, 89 RBIs, despite losing time after colliding with Royals catcher Mike McFarland. He returns in 1998 for his last season, and just 2 weeks shy of his 42nd birthday on August 8th, he collects 5 hits, and he steals his 500th career base versus the Baltimore Orioles. In retirement, the honors poured his way. On June 11th, he returns to County Stadium where the Brewers retire his number 4. That summer, he was ranked the 99th greatest player ever by the Sporting News, and he was a finalist for MLB's All-Century Team. And although Molly knew he wanted to remain connected to the game after his retirement, he did turn down an opportunity to join the Brewers front office. His first year away from baseball, he just wanted to relax and enjoy life. He did some part-time work in the Twins broadcast booth. He went to Bruce Springsteen concerts around the world. Joined the Twins staff in 2000 as a bench coach. And 2003 becomes the team's roving minor league instructor. And 2015 becomes the Twins manager for 4 years, leading the club to the playoffs in 2017. From 2000 to 2014, he bounced around a series of baseball jobs as mainly a coach or instructor, but his personal life became uncomfortably public and complex. In 2003, Paul and his longtime wife Linda divorced. Mahler had fathered a son with Joanna Andreu a couple years earlier and was now paying child support. While the Mahlers were legally separated, Paul fathered a daughter with another woman. In 2004, he married the child's mother, Destiny, and he and his second wife, they have 2 children. His behavior and subsequent divorce caused such hurt and anger that his ex-wife and daughter almost did not attend this Hall of Fame induction ceremony. On January 6, 2004, in his first year of eligibility, Mahler was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. He and Dennis Eckersley were inducted together. And a clearly emotional Mahler thanked the most important people in his life. And he also talked about some highly personal issues, including his son Joshua and his own drug abuse. He also reviewed his career, reminiscing, "The baseball memories are great, but when you think about your career, the people memories are even better." And check it out, Priest. I think that's how I'm going to end the Molly bio this week. There's a lot of things out there about Paul Mahler still dying to be observed. So by all means, fire up the old Google machine and jump into that Paul Mahler rabbit hole if you feel inspired to learn more. I had a lot of fun this week putting in the work on Mahler's life and career, and I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed preaching his gospel. And I promise, Freaks, I'll try to be even better next week. But before I head out like a baby and get you Freaks back to your loved ones patiently awaiting your return to Terrapin Station, let's take one final look at those oh-so-lovely Paul Mahler stats he left behind on his Hall of Fame resume.
All right, what we got here?
Paul Leo Molitor, born August 22nd, 1956 in St. Paul, Minnesota. Drafted by the Cardinals in the 1974 June Amateur Draft and by the Milwaukee Brewers in the first round, third pick overall in the 1977 June Amateur Draft out of the University of Minnesota. He became the 13,999th player to join the MLB fraternity when he made his major league debut on April 7, 1998 versus the Baltimore Orioles, going 2-for-4 versus Mike Flanagan. 21-year baseball playing career with the Brewers, Twins, and Blue Jays. 7-time All-Star, 4-time Silver Slugger Award, 1993 World Series MVP, 2017 Manager of the Year for the Twins. 75.6 wins above replacement, 2,683 games, 12,167 plate appearances, the 17th most in baseball history. 1,782 runs scored, 21st most, 234 home runs, 3,319 hits, the 11th most ever, sandwiched between Albert Pujols at 10 and Eddie Collins at 12. 605 doubles, 15th most ever, 114 triples, 1,307 RBI, 504 stolen bases, 39th most swipes ever, 131 times caught, 1,094 walks, 1,244 strikeouts, 4,854 total bases. His 2,366 singles are the 12th most in the game's history. And he became the fifth player to collect 3,000 hits with 500 stolen bases. A 306, 369, 448 slash, 817 OPS, 122 OPS plus. And man, oh man, was that guy clutch when it mattered. In 5 postseason appearances, he slashed 359, 427, 598 with a 1.026 OPS. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, seamen of all ages, this is the story of Paul Molitor, the igniter. But don't call him that, call him Paul or Molly. And man, I tell you, I always been a fan of Molitor. There's a lot of things I didn't know. And I rather enjoyed that. Now, I'm so grateful to have Molly in my collection of ball players and his stories. My boy Charlie Guns is tapping his left paw, which is his sign to tell me it's time to get your freaks back to Terrapin Station. And as we find our way home, I can see the Paul Molitor bio getting smaller and smaller in the rearview mirror. So with that in mind, I now turn my attention to I never say die baseball Hydra, and I chop the head off that beast, only to see two more baseball topics appear in its place. Let's see. What is next week's topic here? Oh, you know what I want to do? The all-season free agent market just stopped this year after Nola, Otani, and Yamamoto brokered their deals. I mean, it just came to a sudden stop. Jordan Montgomery just signed with the Snakes like 3 days before opening day. Blake Snell signed with the Giants just a week before that. And sometimes we throw this word collusion around. Or some talking head somewhere is accusing the owners of colluding. Which leads me to wonder, what is collusion? What does it look like? How does it work? And is it possible that we experience it this offseason? I mean, Scott Boras surely believes so. Next week, we're going to talk about collusion and how the owners got caught. Next week's topic, collusion in the 80s. And before I say someone is or isn't colluding, Maybe I should learn a little more about it. Hopefully you'll join me. But y'all know the deal. That's another story. For another pod. Here at Backwards K Pod. And the Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network. Where we collect ball players and their stories. I told you I will never charge you for the baseball content. I'm going to keep coming through with that pre-baseball smoke.
You don't want that smoke?
And I'm going to keep it consistent like the Cobra, Dave Parker. I think I covered my goals and objectives this week. Vinny Vassie. I came, I saw, I conquered. Thank you for coming out. God bless and win the day. And like my boy Shea Hillenbrand told me in our 101 sparring session in the dojo, you go to hell, Andy Pettit. Parents, if you see your kid sitting on the couch like a bored AF, by all means, take those little rugrats outside and play a game of catch. Me and the Polonius Feline, my boy Charlie Guns, we're throwing up our Gunnar Hendersons, y'all. That's our number twos. As in, peace.